Welcome back to episode 304. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. And I would like to congratulate us on being a kind of reincarnation of Nostradamus, our show. It was 500 days ago that the Ukrainian war began. Think of that, 500 days of fighting. And when it began, you'll recall, we had discussed our idea that the war would never end, that it was just a, kind of a way of genociding the Ukrainian people. And this, in fact, has come to pass. And I just wanted to point out that now it is a official policy, the genocide of the Ukrainians, because in the last couple of months, Biden and Lloyd Austin have both admitted that the war is really not a humanitarian intervention on the part of NATO, you know, with the weapons and things that they're giving to the country, but rather it's a war of attrition against Russia. They've actually just flatly stated that the purpose of the war is to degrade Russia's military capacity. Okay, so this is basically the official policy of the US, which obviously commands NATO. So, on the other side, you have the Russians who have the position that they want to denazify the Ukraine and leave it incapable of posing a threat to the Russian nation. However, the war of attrition that the West is waging against the Russians is not going well. In fact, Russia has, a larger army, more military munition factories, and its economy is doing better than before the war began.
So much for degrading, right? So.
Well, my point is that this is kind of problematic for the Ukrainians, because the tool that NATO is using to degrade Russia is the Ukrainian people. And when you get these official positions of the two sides in the conflict, that this is a war of attrition, and that there really isn't any political purpose, it is basically depopulation is the goal. And you're the Ukrainians, and now you are 500 days in, and you're about 1 million casualties, which would be my rough approximation of what they've suffered. Somewhat close to half the population is left. So yesterday we had this kind of environmental, public event, and our congressperson was going to attend, at least I was led to believe he was. And I was going to ask him if I had a chance, I was gonna go salute. The war of attrition is not going well. Russia looks pretty good. So the question is simply this: what is the number of Ukrainian casualties that has to exist before you will think that this is a bad idea? I just think that you should publicly state the number, because is it, we've had like 1 million casualties, would it be 2 million? Is that the point where you'd say this is just a bad idea, we're losing too many Ukrainians? Or is it 5 million Ukrainians, or is it the whole country? Because you really need to make a public disclosure of the actual number that would be sufficient to demonstrate that the war of attrition was simply a bad idea. It's too costly. Russia is too hard to attrit with NATO military, techniques being operated through Ukraine. And then let's just try to hit the negotiating table and see what we can salvage for the Ukrainian people. I am bringing this up not just as to commemorate the 500 days of the fighting, but because this week NATO will meet, and they're going to, of course, bring up the question of Ukrainian membership into NATO, and they're also going to be bringing up the question of how they're going to keep supplying munitions. To digress, you probably noticed this big kerfuffle concerning the cluster bombs that the U.S. mm-hmm. is sending to the Ukrainian now. Perhaps mm-hmm. you see. Okay, well, what that is all about is people really don't understand exactly what is occurring here. The reason why they're doing that, why they're giving the Ukrainian these Ukrainian cluster bombs, is not because they want to escalate the technical lethality of the Ukrainian army. Far from it. They're giving them these are 155 millimeter shells. They're to be fired in howitzers. They're giving them to the Ukraine because they're the only 155 millimeter shells that NATO has left to be able to offer Ukraine. They are completely out of these rounds, which are the basic substance of a war of attrition, because
and cluster bombs are particularly cruel because they tend to lay around for very long periods of time, even after the war is over. Yeah,
exactly. But they're not effective at taking out a tank. They're really not any more accurate, or certainly not any more lethal against combat formations than the regular munitions. So this is just being done because it's the last thing they have in the toolbox to hand over to Ukraine.
If I'm not mistaken, aren't they fired and then the shell releases dozens or hundreds of these bombs? And they're shiny and round, so they attract children. Yeah,
exactly. And so the fact is, the Ukrainians, the right-wing zealots that had been attacking, the Russian separatists in the Donbass since 2014 and actually earlier, they had been using these rounds constantly against the Russian-speaking population so often that it had become a cultural trait of the people in Donbass to know what they were and to know how to deal with them. I mean, this is how often these rounds were used by the Ukraine in the 2014 battle that they started to wage against the Russian separatists. So anyway, it's getting the publicity as they're trying to spin it like this is an increase in lethality for the Ukrainians, sort of like the Leopard tanks or maybe the F-16 or some other whiz-bang military gizmo they could give the Ukraine to help them defeat the Russians. But the fact is, it may end up blowing up a few people after the fact, but this isn't going to help them really in the battlefield. The spring and summer offensive is a complete catastrophe, which they're wondering, well, why, since it's obviously the case that the Ukrainians were going to get slaughtered during this offensive, because they have no air cover, and you have to have air cover to advance in the modern battlefield. Otherwise, the opponent with that capacity will simply, spot you and then blow you all up. Why would they invade? What is the point of this offensive? They're saying that they wanted to impress NATO that there was some payoff for their investment in arms and training by having some kind of dramatic breakthrough against the Russian lines. There was just not even a reasonable chance. There was no chance whatsoever. The Ukrainians never got to any of the actual Russian defensive lines. What they got to was this gray area, which is maintained by the Russians in front of their defensive lines as a killing zone. The Ukrainians advanced in. All of these areas were precisely mapped by the Russians for artillery rounds. They can see everything that the Ukrainians are bringing forward, and they just slaughtered them. The estimates are between 20 and 30,000 Ukrainians that have been killed so far. There's nothing to show for it. They haven't gained a meter, in fact. So why did they do it? Well, Tim, I'm going to go back to our conversations 500 days ago and just say the war is simply the narrative. It's the cover story. The purpose here is simply genocide. This is just population reduction.
Yep. And a lot of money laundering.
Mm-hmm. Hand in hand, yep.
And a pretext for all the problems in Europe, Germany's deindustrialization, the denial, destruction of energy. This is also not directly related to the Ukraine war, but it's going on in the Netherlands. There's huge protests now. I think the government there declared a state of emergency to prevent a mass protest against the seizure of farms that's going on. And there's mass resistance to that. I think more than 10,000 farmers are being the government seeking to shut them down under the pretext of the environment, with chemical fertilizers and emissions, which is an absurd claim. But one of the casualties of the Ukraine Russia war is the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was supposed to be feed German industry and German civilians heat and energy. And that's being denied to them. That's shutting down the German economy. So, yeah. Again, all of it could have been avoided. We all know who instigated it, who provoked it. It was the United States and NATO.
Yeah, I wanted to comment. You brought up the absurd climate change rationale for shutting down the Belgian farmers. I wanted to one up you, if you don't mind, with an even more preposterous rationale. Using climate change. In Australia, the birth rates are continuing to decline and are now demanding an explanation. Obviously, the vaccine is what was correlated to this phenomena, but the Australian government has determined that there was another cause. It is not the vaccine. The cause of the declining birth is climate change. It has affected the behavior of young. I'm serious. I think I'm kidding. No, they've issued a release that climate change is responsible for the decline in birth. They're suggesting that there's less sexual activity, and if we want to fix this, we simply have to, of course, fix climate change by stopping to eating meat and things like this to help the environment heal itself. So, diminishing returns, Tim, they're just lying everywhere. And more, I think it's becoming obvious.
So it's just too hot or too cold to hook up?
Okay. One or the other, because there sure aren't any babies being born.
Yeah, it's not. Well, I don't. What's the abortion rate in Australia?
Tie.
So
that's well, okay. The raw number is less now because there's just so many pregnancies. I mean, I'll send some data for you if you're curious. I mean, it is just incredible.
How many women are on birth control in Australia?
Oh, I'm sure it's very high.
And I think was it 1 in 3 in the United States?
Yeah, something like that. But the thing is, these are what I'm talking about is a relative change. In other words, since the time of the vaccine, all of these trends have become dramatically worse. If you want to fix this, then all of these things have to be addressed. But the idea that it's climate change is ridiculous. And hopefully the Australian people will, kind of understand that they're being lied to. They're being lied to. The people in Belgium are being lied to. The people in Ukraine are being lied to. Everyone is being lied to. And it's hopefully just getting more and more obvious that we have to make a very serious political U-turn here.
Did you see I think the Russians, in response to the Biden administration's policy in Ukraine, they were able to plant cocaine in the White House.
Yes, they're so clever.
Yeah. Apparently, there was a story. The White House had to call on a hazmat evacuation team to deal with this. I guess they weren't sure if it's cocaine or maybe they thought it was anthrax or something. I didn't think cocaine was a hazardous material unless you ingested it one way or the other. But apparently, it got out that there's cocaine in the White House. It was reported. I find it interesting that the story leaked to begin with. It seems to me that if they really wanted to contain this, they could, because it's the White House. But somehow got reported. Of course, this was right after a Hunter Biden visit to the White House. And there was a videotape of the Biden family on the White House balcony, I think on the 4th of July. And Hunter Biden is looking real strung out there.
I mean, the White House has really, is no longer kind of the Jackie Kennedy cultural treasure, that it once was. I don't know if you saw the video of the drag queen visit to the White House 2 weeks ago. So a bunch of them were brought in. Biden gave a speech saying, how wonderful you are for the nation and cultural treasures. And then a group of them and these are drag queens who've been physically augmented, went topless to show off their pseudo femininity. And this was videotaped. And
I don't know, is it illegal for like a man who's had breast implants and fake breasts created? Is that illegal for him to flash those breasts?
You know, that's kind of, you know, these are the new questions of culture that have to be resolved. These are important questions, but it's so vulgar to do it on White House grounds that that arrest should have been made immediately. But
this isn't the first time that the White House has been sullied. I mean, think of the men who've inhabited that office and. Remember Bill Clinton and Chris the Cigar and Monica Lewinsky and all that. And I'm sure that isn't the first time that cocaine's been ingested in the White House.
I think hopefully it wouldn't surprise me if the whole thing runs on drugs. Not just cocaine, but they have all those, bizarre amphetamines, uppers, downers, micro dosing. And these people are so evil and so murderous, they have to probably deal with normal guilt feelings by using drugs. I think it wouldn't surprise me at all if it just runs on drugs. But of course, it's irrelevant because the White House has nothing to do with political policy or running the country. It's just there as a cartoon, basically, to make the American population think that what we're given as democracy has some kind of meaning.
What is more salacious stories that cover up maybe more relevant, like the bribery scandals involving the Biden family and the money laundering and the tax scandals and the fact that the Hunter Biden, the Biden family is receiving preferential treatment from the Justice Department, the corruption of the Justice Department, and let's talk about cocaine and these things. And they say they may never know how it got there. We know. You would think there are plenty of security cameras and logs and time and know who's there and when, and they might even try to fingerprint the bag. I don't know. And also, it's a bag of cocaine. Cocaine isn't cheap, is it? I mean, that's got to be worth a lot of money just to leave it there. Yeah,
absolutely.
But it could have been planted. What do you do when you want to manage a story? You release another scandal, which however salacious, doesn't have quite the political threat, because it's just more Hunter Biden dick pics, whores, guns, and cocaine,
Right, and then bear in mind, there isn't any conclusion or revelation to the public as a result of this, the whole media and legal process. Mm-hmm. This is a genre, from Monica Lewinsky, just think of, Anthony Weiner's laptop. I mean, this potential salacious revelation that will have, enormous political, manifestations. They these things just come up over and over again and never go anywhere. No. They somehow it's like Epstein with the list of people that were involved in pedophilia that was supposed to get released at some point and never did. It's happened so often. It's such a repetitive event that I would just describe it as a genre, and it's just there to distract. What they're doing is they're just using low-grade pornography, mixing that with a little bit of political comeuppance, getting people, getting politicians will find a way to, bring them to heel. And this attracts the attention of, the media, certainly. They run with these stories time over and over again. And that's what the public sees. And at the end of the day, you just get a whiff of pornography and the sense that there's nothing you can do in terms of this democracy to bring about any kind of political change, because they're all just so corrupt and crazy at the top that we just have to just live our lives and put up with all of this.
Yeah, in many ways, Joe Biden is a... the perfect president for our times, for our declining republic. The Bidens, they exude a certain amount. Well, at least they express a certain level of depravity which is so part of public life, politics, finance, everything in our country is so corrupt, criminal justice system, education. So again, he's the perfect president for our times, personification of our failing state.
You know, that's a good point. He is. He's absolutely perfect. You know, endless incoherent wars, salacious and degenerate family members, and dawning senility. I mean, if that isn't America, I just don't know what is. I mean, it's they are the representation of what's occurring to us, and that's why they're there. I mean, I think you are right, and I think that was the purpose of having this family, you know, in the White House at this time.
It serves a purpose because, although, you know, they had this type of depravity, corruption at the high level, so obvious, but at the same time, with a political crisis and economic crisis, that perhaps it will alert the public to what needs to be done. Whereas, like in the 90s with Clinton and the Clinton depravity and corruption, you had the go-go 90s. I remember at the time people not wanting to worry about it because times were good and they equated someone with if a president was impeached and removed from office, that might affect the stock market. And that's perhaps why we are today, is that notion, that sort of worship of mammon and materialism and not worrying about, you know, rule of law or decency or morality. As long as your 401k was going up, don't worry about it, because you can, whatever problems exist in society, you can make enough money and get away from it. And perhaps this is sort of retribution for that attitude that America has exuded for the past 30, 40 years.
Oh boy, you are so right, Tim, and incidentally, really well spoken. I mean, this is the problem. We've crawled into the enclaves. The white European male, you know, has just given up any belief in his political power and now is just looking for enclaves. That's what they are. Lots of money, good, sturdy enclave, and video games or whatever distractions they want. But as far as, you know, going into political action, they just are, they're kind of stupefied, right? I mean, the political activity is coming from, you know, the white males that are in politics. They're all just, you know, lifetime actors, in my opinion. I mean, they're particularly the ones that are rising through the ranks, they're just controlled. And so we really don't have any political representation. I mean, this is really kind of a hard fact for a lot of European Americans to get their minds around. But as I see it, we have zero political power at the federal level, none, not a bit. And then you go into the states. Well, I think maybe a few of the governors are legit, but I think vast majority of them would probably have no trouble being at a cocktail cocaine party with Gavin Newsom. We just don't have any representation at that level. And that's a dangerous place to be when the government has access to the kind of technology and weapons that are being, you know, developed. So I would, you know, hope that we could encourage the European American to come out of his enclave and get into the political street and try to regain some power, because your enclaves aren't going to hold together. No, they won't, not eventually. I mean, this, of course, has been clear in France over the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The French had a whole strategy of suburbs. I'm not, you know, sure you're familiar with this, but the French suburbs were seen as kind of a solution for the enormous immigrant waves into France, you know, that the French culture could still exist in these areas outside Paris and lower cities. But obviously that's just a fantasy. You know, the suburban strategy isn't going to exist, and the French culture is just completely on the chopping block. It's going to disappear, as will the French people. I mean, in Europe today, there are certainly 45 million African immigrants in Europe today, 45 million. So that's like 10% of the population, more, 15%. Now, these are different than the European populations because they're all breeding age. Okay. Mm-hmm. So where are you going to be in like 60 years, given these statistics? I think it's pretty clear you're going to be in a situation where there really won't be any meaningful European population, right? I mean, they will be inbred, they will be phased out by old age and death. And the what remains will be not capable of any political regeneration because they will become the minority. So this is the obvious trajectory of the immigration.
You'd have to show me the arithmetic on how you're not going to get to the condition I just described in 60 years.
So this is what's going to happen. It's literally, the immigration policy is literally a death sentence for the distinct European cultures and ethnicities. So the idea that that wasn't the goal is far-fetched, right? I mean, how could you make such a blunder? Oh my God, we destroyed the French people accidentally. It's like the destruction of the Ukrainian population going on now, you know, by this accidental genocidal war. I mean, these are just stupid cover narratives. And the fact is that the French rioting, the rioting by the immigrants in France, it should be a wake-up call to the French people that this is an undigestible, process. It isn't going to end up with, a slightly modified French culture in 50 years. It's going to end up in 50 years with no French culture, zero.
Yeah, as you mentioned, France right now is confronted with unprecedented waves of riots, leaving a trail of destruction, chaos. The triggering event supposedly was a shooting death of a teenager of Algerian descent by a police officer. He was too young to drive a vehicle. I think he's 17. The age of driving for legal driving in France is 18, I believe. He was pulled over and tried to escape. Now in France, there's a law when someone drives away to shoot them. Now this is in response, I think, to the Nice truck bombing. So they've had problems with terrorism and car bombs and truck bombs and people using vehicles as terrorist weapons. And apparently this is legal. Nevertheless, the officer involved has been charged with involuntary manslaughter, perhaps an attempt to assuage the mob. The Ministry of the Interior has released figures that expose the true extent of the devastation. I think at this point, almost 6,000 vehicles have been destroyed, burned, set on fire. Over 1,000 buildings, and it's ongoing. It's apparently spreading into some of the small towns. Again, predictable considering that there's been a mass importation of people from North Africa and Africa into France. No one asked the French. This was a European Union decision that was taken in the past 10, 15 years. And so it's basically they created a time bomb, and it, or just a more like a just something like a very combustible situation, is to say. And so now it's apparently this event, this is sort of like a George Floyd moment in France, and the government itself, while trying to lose control, has sought to blame social media. Of course, social media. It's no. Funny because white people or French have access to social media. They're not rioting because of it. So I guess it facilitates it somewhat through communications. You can create flash mobs, if you will. But really, this is a consequence of the immigration policies that have been instituted continental wide in Europe, creating a subgroup or a minority population that's volatile and easily triggered and that can be instrumentalized, which I think this is what's happened here. From what I understand, Macron, although he is a tool of NATO, has expressed some skepticism about NATO's war or NATO's policies or U.S. Policies regarding the Russo-Ukrainian war. I believe he tried to also purchase some petroleum, not using dollars. So that somehow may have play some part in this, sort of either a shot across the bow or an attempt at regime change. This isn't unprecedented, of course. In 1968, President de Gaulle was unseated when student riots broke out in France in the summer of 1968. This turns out these riots weren't completely organic. These were swarming techniques developed by the CIA to destabilize the French government for the French government's move against the US dollar, which is under a lot of stress. Of course, 3 years later, the Bretton Woods system collapsed. And but he was making moves to push the United States to impose currency reforms because the value of the dollar versus the franc and other European currencies had really fallen, but it was being propped up because of the Bretton Woods system. And France was demanding redemption on gold. And US was running out of gold reserves. So that factored into this. And so you had the riots of 68. There is a precedent for this. I came across this article. This was at the National Justice Party's website, Joseph Jordan. The US government is responsible for France's anti-white race riots. And he writes, in the last week, the banlieues surrounding French Jews at the suburbs, I guess, French major cities have erupted in flames and anarchy with at least one confirmed death, hundreds of injuries, and approaching €1 billion worth of damage. Of course, the claimed catalyst for this European episode of American-style anti-white racial chaos was the death of a 17-year-old Maghrebi criminal named Noual Mazouk, who was shot by a police officer after attempting to escape in his car during an arrest. Let me go to here. French media initially cited, the situation is reminiscent of the 2020 race riots that gripped the United States following the death of George Floyd. That is not a coincidence. The French media initially sided with the police in the story. This is where it gets interesting. The tune changed after a short, out of context clip of the incident was pounced upon by local agents of the Washington U.S. State Department trained Rokhaya Diallo, who has taken to friendly British and American media to flout French's strict incitement laws and openly condone the criminal violence while defaming the white French without any counter argument. These riots are a product of deliberate malice brought to fruition by more than a decade of covert and overt influence operations seeking to transform France's black and brown criminal population into a permanent Jewish American imperial foothold. This is one of the earliest records of this intelligence operation is a series of classified U.S. embassy cables from 2010, publicized by WikiLeaks. In these memos, the Hollywood Jewish mogul Charles Rifkin, then appointed ambassador to France by the Obama administration, outlines a 7-point plan for mobilizing blacks and Maghrebis in France as a political cudgel against her hosts. In the nefarious memo, Rifkin laments that French institutions are overwhelmingly white and draws upon a plan to build State Department-backed parallel between media outlets, NGOs, and educational entities to undermine and replace the established order. In pursuit of the goal of de-Europeanizing France, the Jewish ambassador calls for mobilizing U.S. influence to intensify our work with the French museums and educators to reform the history curriculum taught in French schools, using new media to indoctrinate non-white youth in France and support, train, and engage media and political activists who share our values. The cable summarizes the agenda by instructing Washington's agents to build on the expansive public diplomacy programs already in place at post and develop creative additional means to influence the youth of France, employing new media, corporate partnerships, nationwide competitions, targeted outreach events, especially invited U.S. guests to identify and influence future French leaders. Rifkin would eventually utilize his contacts in Hollywood to recruit American celebrities like Samuel L. Jackson to accompany him to French ghettos to help him recruit potential operatives. Several anti-white activists and institutions dedicated to inciting non-white people against the police and French society that they chose to live in have since emerged from this conspiracy. Figures such as the aforementioned Diallo, who is now arguably the most prominent French activist on the planet, thanks to the platform granted by her US media, and the Jew Tara Dickman of the Collective Against Racial Profiling and Anti-Police Group, were brought to America by the US Embassy and affiliated Atlanticist NGOs to be trained in Bolshevistic agitation techniques in such cities as Chicago. Following this outreach, Dickman noted that she applied American strategies back in France to lead an avalanche of racial profiling lawsuits against police in hopes of hamstringing their ability to enforce the law against African and Algerian criminals, effectively willing a previously non-existent issue into existence. As a result, cops in France have been neutered in respect to non-white crime under immense coordinated legal and media and global political pressure. The once relatively safe European nation is now consumed by ethnic and interracial violence. Some French politicians, such as a parliament member, Nicolas Dupont-Aignan, have openly condemned America's visible and covert hand behind the rise of white guilt narratives, anti-white violence, and coercive well-funded agitation in the country. Even Emmanuel Macron, Macron, the platform, the platonic form of the neoliberal, has condemned Judeo-American wokeism role in destabilizing the nation and inflaming a racial conflict. Though the consciousness of what is happening is high among the French, little is being done to counter the influence from its NATO ally, which aggressively spies on its political leaders with no diplomatic consequences. Several influential French figures and leaders, such as the former presidents François Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy, who is Jewish, are alumni of Washington's influence and asset recruitment operations, including the State Department's International Visitors Leadership Program. France's elites are highly compromised by the United States, which has prevented meaningful solidarity from forming against Washington's meddling. The never-ending nightmare of the never-ending nightmare of Jewish rulers of America, subject us at home, is for expert as current Secretary of State Anthony Blinken co-wrote with his former accomplice Robert Kagan in 2019. Blinken makes clear that any nation in the economic and military sphere of influence of Washington will have its native culture and people targeted for attack. And those who resist must be crushed. If those who happen to be white, the policy will take a particularly cruel and ferocious form. So that was, it's a long book that I read, but I think he exposed what's going on here. I came across this for more than a decade. The U.S. Embassy is promoting diversity in France, promoting immigrants and these things in order to challenge or erase, you know, native French culture. So again, there's good reason to suspect that this is a sort of a colored revolution, using people of color to carry out a color revolution. Ongoing policy, which you talked about, is sort of erasing or doing away with the white European ethnic state, you know.
Yeah, that's an amazing article. And
did you see the cable?
Pardon me?
You see the cable that I sent you from Rifkin?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it was a summary of cable. This is back in 2010, what he referred to. And he says, this is Rifkin. Now, Rifkin's a Jewish mogul, Hollywood. Why is he the ambassador to France? And why is a Jewish mogul turned diplomat concerned about the racial makeup or culture of the host country? He's there to represent the United States with France. He's there to try to change France. Do we just take this as normal? I'm just saying. Why is the United States lecturing France on its demographic makeup, representation? I mean, he's there just to press U.S. interest and to smooth relations with a foreign nation. That's what an ambassador is supposed to do. He's not supposed to use the embassy as a base for destabilizing the country, which evidently it is. That's what this cable proves.
And yeah, that's an amazing cable. And I haven't been able to go through a process of vetting it, but I have a feeling it just sounds like it's absolutely legit.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be something that is widely circulated among French people. They should know that this is exactly what's going on. I wonder to what extent these ideas are in circulation because I'll just give you two examples of unusual resistance to the current political lineup. One is the statement that the police unions of France created to Macron, and they said that today the police are in combat as we're at war.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow we will be in the resistance and the government should be aware of this. In other words, this is fighting words, right? There, they're saying, you know, the government is lost control and the police are going to defend themselves. Because bear in mind, I don't know how many hundreds of police stations were attacked, but it was in the hundreds. And then the other quote that caught my mind was, a general, Pierre Villeres, I'm mispronouncing it, but he said that he made a statement saying the army should be loyal to people, not to Macron. He actually made that statement. So these seem to be more clear-minded in their, in the way that they're kind of describing their situation. And if this is the case, then there just has to be more and more of this strain of information given to the French people so they can actually make some political change. When you talk about the color revolution, well, just bear in mind that a lot of the weapons used in the streets of French cities in the last couple of weeks come through the U.S. weapons that were donated to the Ukraine.
Well, yeah, because they lost track of them.
Yeah, they somehow found their way back into the streets of the French city. So this is really just one, satanic process that brings these people there, the immigrants. They do not have the skills of, needed to to merge into the French culture seamlessly. They are outsiders. You then have agitations, sort of narratives are given to them about the righteousness of their, cause to overthrow the colonialists. And then the next thing you know, weapons are available. And then here you go, you have this moment where French culture is just shattered. So the question is where does France go from here? You have 15% of the population is in league with these ideas, right? I mean, you're not reading a lot of North American immigrants standing up for the French police response to the riots. What you're seeing is they are basically monolithic. They think that they're justified in this. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with this population?
I guess mass importation, the only solution is mass deportation.
Right. And now you see the problem of having become a member of the EU, because the EU controls the immigration policies. Mm-hmm. All of those non-elected bureaucrats and regulations and laws that will be used to prevent the French from deporting anyone.
Well, I do think there's a pattern here. You have this guy Rivkin, who's Jewish, Hollywood mogul, who goes to France 12, 13 years ago, and he's there working to destabilize the country by promoting diversity, of course, because that's apparently, and it's under the guise of making France more secure, that's within U.S. interests. Right. To make more secure, to make our ally more secure. Well, obviously importing hundreds of thousands, millions of refugees from North Africa and Africa into France and putting them on welfare is going to stabilize the country. It's going to destabilize the country. So their objective is quite the opposite. And so I didn't know this, but France has a diversity czar. So his name was under Sarkozy, who was Jewish, of course, was Yazid Sabeg. Now, I couldn't confirm whether or not he was Jewish or not, but he was probably is. And his job was to diversify France. And why is that an objective? And why is that an objective that the U.S. Embassy is concerned with? Well, this goes to this, why here we have, another Jew using his in a diplomatic position, working to promote diversity, destabilize the country by bringing in mass immigration. And this is something we see throughout the world, whether it's in Great Britain, it was Barbara Roche, who's Jewish, who championed mass immigration of the country to change the country's demographics. In Ireland, you have this guy, Alan Shatter, who was Jewish, and he was Minister of the Interior or Justice Minister, who oversaw the relaxation of Irish immigration laws and bringing in mass importation to Ireland. Now, I don't know what a Jew has serving in the Irish government. Irishman who's Jewish is a contradiction in term. Ireland is a Catholic state. So, and of course, in the United States, you have Ayanna Mohorkas, who's Jewish and who's in control of the Department of Homeland Security. Merrick Garland, our Justice Department, our Attorney General, is Jewish. Of course, Anthony Blinken, our Secretary of State, is Jewish. And they're overseeing an immigration crisis, a border crisis in the United States that's dissolving the country as we speak. Again, we have a pattern of Jews overseeing this in Europe and the United States. So is it U.S. policy? I don't know. We call it United States policy because the United States government has been taken over, apparently, to serve these globalist cosmopolitan Jewish interests.
It certainly seems clear, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
I mean, how would you articulate another explanation? What would another explanation be like? Well, if it isn't sort of the same interest in the destruction of European and Christian culture that you see, for example, in the authoritarian personality, I think mm-hmm. it's very clear there. then what is it? Why would the EU commissioners bring in 40 million people from North Africa to Europe?
At the same time, NATO had destabilized those regions, like overthrowing Gaddafi, or Syria, you know, creating a civil war in Syria, or, you know, why is U.S. government importing hundreds of thousands of people from Somalia into the United States and dumping them in Minnesota or Maine, for that matter? You know, how does it benefit the United States?
Yeah, well, how does the immigration policy that the EU has hoisted on it benefit France? It doesn't. It's just so the situation is pretty clear and it's pretty dire. If you care about any kind of European ethnicity or culture, what has happened is that the political class has been taken over. There's no way to describe it. It's been a manipulation of democracy, particularly with the use of media, but other methods as well over the long haul. And now you have a situation where, as I was talking about earlier, you just don't have much political power, any real political power, in the hands of legitimate heritage Americans. You know, we are on the outside looking in. If we're lucky, we have enough money to live in an enclave. If not, we just keep our mouth shut. So this is our condition. And we really do need to start to express more courage because, well, we're being genocided in this kind of slow motion political process that is organized against us. And, it's picking up speed.
It definitely appears to be escalating. It's rapidly becoming like a military situation in France.
It is a military situation in France. Yeah.
See what's happened in Germany. The Green Party is still trying to press its environmental energy bill, which is actually just a deindustrialization plan for Germany. It's being stopped in the courts now. But there is a political reaction. You had the alternative party in Germany that won those elections?
I don't know the name of them.
I think it's AZD or something.
That's how I know them. But they are gaining ground because the Green Party is now being exposed as just using the environmental, you know, kind of interests of the German people as a camouflage for deindustrialization and then following that for depopulation.
It's gaining ground, winning elections. And there was a Jewish guy in Germany who said the party needs to be liquidated or declared illegal to protect democracy.
Right. funny how contradictions can, how they're able to swallow contradictions without hiccuping. You know, they just, it doesn't bother them at all.
In order, you got to destroy democracy to protect democy.
Of course. So they define democracy as when they win and when we lose. That is democracy. That's how democracy's always been. That's the only world they know. And so that's just what democracy means to them. You know, they control the media, which creates the candidates, which are under control of this narrow Judeo-Masonic organization. And then you end up with the heritage European cultures being damaged, shrinking, and on the way to extinction. And they can't complain because that would be undemocratic. That's the democratic process that, you know.
Yeah, kind of what we're witnessing in France perhaps is yet another color revolution. I guess the question whether or not how much of it is organic or, you know, emerging behavior, as I say, just emerging from the conditions that the EU has created in France, or whether this is a specific plan. Again, it is interesting that Macron had taken had moved to actually separate himself as government from some of the policies, and also policies that would also challenge the petrodollar. And all of a sudden, this breaks out in France. Again, similar to what happened in 1968 in France too.
I would just say, you know, Macron as a kind of a independent agent is just an obvious distraction and ludicrous because he's 100% Rothschild bagman. World Economic Forum. This is not someone who's going to actually do some kind of contestation of the destructive process. he's just going to, you know, like give lip service to them, which becomes a kind of cul-de-sac, where if he, you know, says, well, we're not going to allow Ukraine into NATO, you know, we're going to take this heroic stance, you know, we don't think the war is good for the Ukraine, something like this. Okay, great. That's great. I mean, is that going to lead to, you know, the U.S. and European countries to pulling, you know, their support from the Ukraine? What difference does it make if Ukraine's in the NATO or not? It means nothing at all. It's irrelevant. It's just an issue that they can argue over and people can become upset about one way or another. So what? You know, the Ukrainian situation, which Macron is going to be kind of front and center on in the next week, because the NATO, their summit basically is going to be held, and the Ukrainian going forward policies will be an issue. And the world, I mean, and the country leaders will make public statements concerning, you know, this process. And I'm sure Macron is going to be kind of, you know, the black sheep, and just create the position, you know, the idea that there is some sort of, you know, legitimate consideration going on as to how the war should be waged and what NATO's position should be. And the public will sit there, you know, kind of slack-jawed in amazement, staring up at the thing. This is all theater, in my opinion. It's just, Macron, if he had any sort of legitimate, you know, kind of instinct to represent the French people, he should have been demanding massive deportation over the last 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's not going to get to that point. He's going to like talk about a process, and the process is infinite, it never ends. And in the meantime, the immigrants will just continue to come in, will continue to embed themselves inside of the country. And at a certain point, it really doesn't matter what happens, because there's just too many of them to leave, and their process of moving forward as humans will just extinguish the French population. That's just what's going to happen. It'll just be baked in the cake. So, you know, for, you know, a politician like Macron to not take that position, to not understand it, to not see the future of where the demographic steamroll goes, I mean, it's ridiculous. Of course he can see it. Everyone can see it. He just is going to talk, you know, sideways and make a lot of confusing statements and give the hope that something will happen. I mean, even the conservative French politicians, I think, are complicit. You know, you really need to have a clear-minded and clear-spoken representation of the French people come forward and just say, look, I'm a French European descended individual. This is what France means to me. And this, what's going on, is going to destroy it. This is a kind of warfare that's being waged against me. And I'm here to try to lead the French people in the battle, and just let the chips fall. Just say, look, that's what I'm here for. I think the people would rally to them and to that kind of person who spoke honestly. And if nothing else, just getting the idea out clearly would start the process in which the people who are capable of making a change, you know, to stop accepting the EU slavery and mind control, the people who are capable of transitioning would be put on an alert and maybe start moving in the right direction.
Well, maybe all the Muslims in France should go to Palestine to defend the Palestinians from the latest offensive from Israel.
Well, don't you think that the person who was so interested in diversity would want to like help that immigration policy?
Yeah, at the same time, we're being told that Israel must maintain its purity.
Yeah.
To maintain its ethnic state status, which is true, I guess. But I'm saying, why? I mean, why not have, you know, Israel for Jews and France for the French?
Yeah, we've 100
Germany times. For the Germans.
Yeah, we've talked about this 100 times. It's like, you know, whenever you get like a sort of a Jewish political individual inside a traditionally European Christian culture, and this individual is talking about the need for, you know, we've just got to like become more multicultural, more multi-ethnic, and break down the racism.
That makes, somehow that makes you stronger. I don't understand how that works.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you should say, this is great. You know, like, show us your sincerity. We want to make sure it's such an important political transition. Prove you're not a hypocrite. Go to Israel. Make these changes come about there. You know, you've got this weird religion there that talks about the genocide of the ethnicities and, the chosen people and God giving you this land. I mean, these are insane ideas, right? You should go there and help. You can clean that mess up. Go there and then fix that and make it into a true multicultural paradise, a workers' paradise for all people. We'll listen, we'll watch, and then we can take you seriously. But if you don't, then you just look like a bold-faced hypocrite who is here to destroy us and then slink back to Israel from where you can rule the world.
Yeah, I do find it interesting. The U.S. Embassy is spearheading this effort to change curriculum, sort of demoralize the French people, promote their own 1619 project there to soften them up for one thing is a sort of a cultural decapitation before literal genocide and civil war, and civil war is unleashed on them just through the mere importation of people who are going to the street fighting. Then you have this arena of fighting that's created in the Ukraine with the Russo-Ukrainians fighting. And you have this bizarre weapons that go in there, it gets lost, and now it's ending up in the French streets and not anywhere else because, you know, anyone buys bitter. Who knows who's paying for what there? You've created a situation rife for civil war. And it's pretty predictable from the standpoint of if you're a politician and you're trying to devise policies for the welfare of your people here, that you'd say, no, this is bad for France. And whatever problems Libya has or North Africa, Algeria, or Somalia has, it's not going to be solved, nor is it the response for the French people to have to take in these people, solve them in those areas. And it would do a lot of good, again, if NATO and the United States and Israel weren't working to undermine those governments as a part of a greater Israel plan, like the Oda Ninan plan. And that's all part of that. The destabilization of the Middle East and the North and North Africa is all part of NATO and Israel's war for conquest. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, there's a heavy Jewish hand in all of this, whether it's a destabilization of the American regime here at home or in Europe. And each time you have Jewish people entrusted with political power, administrative power, using to undermine the integrity and stability of the host nations.
At least Jewish organizations are helping America transition to a better world by inserting the transgender culture. That's working out really well. I don't know if you caught it, but you had the that incredible battle in Baltimore, I believe, and or was it Philadelphia? Yeah, it was July 4th in Philadelphia.
Oh yeah,
and so you had once again, this is the second time now. It was a biological male who apparently self-identifies as a transgender woman. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't really surprise me. I don't know what you think about this, but, if you're taking these hormone blockers and then you have these ideas in your mind, isn't it, kind of to be expected that maybe you will become sort of, well, crazy? I mean, how would you not be, they talk about there was recently this major in the U.S. Army that transitioned. She became a big celebrity in the last 10 days. They had pictures of this individual now, a woman. They were saying, this is like literally saving the life of this individual. The transition has saved the life of this individual because they are now able to really express themselves, and they had suicidal thoughts before. That's very interesting, but if you're going to make these claims, you really want to put them out in context, don't you? Where you should be putting out the context of, well, what is the suicide rate of the people who transgender? Mm-hmm. What is the rate of severe depression? How many of them are autistic? if you actually go through the numbers in a real way, you can see that this group is not exactly classic for the transition from mental illness into the sunlight, right? It seems to be working just the opposite. And of course, there hasn't been enough time to do any kind of long-term studies, which of course will never be done. That would be ridiculous. So this is just another example, in our world where you see, the July 4th rampage, and then at the heart of it, you have someone who's, unfortunately been told it's okay to identify as a transgender woman. And then this person is irrational. Well, who would have thought that could ever happen, So it's just, this is our world, and it's just...
Well, you also have the wholesale corruption of the medical industry and also the psychological association when they claim that this is life-saving care when it is not. It's not life-saving. It's not necessary. And it's just because they're putting a spin on it. They're claiming that somehow this makes this person feel immediately happier because therefore that's not life-saving. And life-saving is when you have open heart surgery or something, and
right.
take out an appendix that's inflamed and you have person's appendix, that's life-saving. Even the language itself, it's affirming, life-saving, all this language, and these are supposed to people you trust with their medical and scientific expertise, where you expect them to use language that has a certain amount of, certainty and exactitude to it. Now they're starting to engage in this mumbo jumbo,
emotive
mumbo jumbo.
It's a heap of mumbo jumbo. They've got all this pseudoscience. At this point, science has been another area that's been taken over, like our political class. It's just, look at the vaccine science,
Here's the thing. It's when a male transitions to a supposed female, and they do the reassignment surgery where they convert a penis into a vagina. And of course, they don't do that because you can't have, if you're male, you can't have a vagina. Only God and nature's God creates that. And so what they do is they create a constant wound, which your body's always trying to heal. And literally you're in order to maintain the myth that you have a female sex organ, the doctors have to prevent it from healing properly. Now, how is that healthcare?
Right, exactly.
Did you see there was a riot it was an attempted pride parade, a gay pride parade in Tbilisi, Georgia. And it was shut down by a mob, and they're complaining because the police just let the mob shut it down. And well, I wonder if the U.S. Embassy was behind that, considering that global homo and sodomy is the number one objective of U.S. foreign policy these days. I have no doubt the U.S. Embassy was organizing that protest. Again, this is all part of destabilization. This is the same thing that Mr. Rifkin was talking about, Ambassador Rifkin in France in 2010, all under the guise of diversity and human rights and representation and these things to strengthen the government. Well, does it strengthen the government? Has this strengthened France, what we're seeing today?
Right. Is that a strong France? Or is it a madhouse? Yeah. So, yeah. The word paradise, illusion that they put in front of people when they start the destruction is, we should be used to that at this point. They've done it 100 times to us, and you just can't trust anyone, that would talk about dramatic cultural change that's going to be for the better. It only involves you giving a lot of political power to me.
What legitimate function does a U.S. ambassador or any ambassador to a host country in working to change the country's demographics, its representation, how many people are represented in government or in a particular industry, in education, or promoting affirmative action in these things in education, lowering academic standards? He's there to represent the United States, U.S. interests, and smooth out any potential conflicts that may occur between the two governments and promote peace, ideally. That's what an ambassador is supposed to be. He isn't supposed to be sent there as an agent of chaos.
You're so right. I mean, it's such a
Why is Rahm Emanuel the ambassador to Japan now?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that is just such a clear way of describing it, is that just ask the question, is this the role of U.S. ambassador?
Well, we know Victoria Nuland. I guess it is.
Right. Like, I guess so.
Her role in the. she's technically an ambassador, right?
Yeah.
She's always starting wars.
Right. So it's just that that job description, which is what I guess our ambassadors, you know, are being hired for, needs to be disclosed. Mm-hmm. When they come in, they should just say, hey, I'm here to basically to destroy your culture, to end it. It's not a good culture in my mind, and I'm here to make sure it doesn't exist in 50 years. You know, be honest about what you're going to do. If they would just do that, then the public could make changes, right, with tar and pitchforks and things like this. But they are able to intimidate, you know, with critical theory, you know, where they just attack people who are, you know, wondering why the ambassador is trying to attack our culture. They intimidate this person by saying, well, you're racist. Mm-hmm. You don't like Black people, I guess, or you don't like Algerians, or, you know. Well, that's really not the question here. The question is, we have our culture, our economy. We want to run it for our benefit, and you're trying to basically change it for your benefit. Well, we're going to fight you.
So here's the thing. If you don't like them, it's not relevant unless you force people to live together.
Right,
exactly. If they're not forced to be neighbors, it doesn't matter because they're not close to each other. They want to know each other. Now, you may or may not like a person from Algeria or from Somalia or whatever. You may run individually, you may befriend someone, but if you send them in the hundreds of thousands, or not millions, in a few years to overwhelm your country and create a cohort that's going to be used to instrumentalize to destabilize your entire society, yeah, you're not going to like them.
Yeah,
you're not going to like them.
Yeah, I mean, French independent journalists, I hope that they you know, work hard and come up with some documentation as to where the weapons are coming from and where the ideas are coming from, because I think they could expose pretty easily the whole weaponization of immigration that the EU bureaucrats have worked against the French people. Because I just feel the trajectory is so, you know, so obvious, so self-evident, that if they put time in and they'd be able to come up with the goods and get, you know, details and things like that. And they should bring out exposés like that. Mm-hmm. Because those kinds of exposés, which are, you know, really exposing, well, basically a racial attack, mm-hmm. in my opinion, are what's needed now to create the right sort of energy and clear-mindedness on the part of the people who are being attacked.
It is racial, because Ambassador Rifkin was saying that France is too French. They're white. That's what he was saying.
Yeah, of course he is.
Well, you are the ambassador of France, moron.
Yeah.
He's not stupid. He's malicious. But it's like, you know, who are you to come in here? I'm going to go to Israel and point out that everyone's too Jewish. You're all too Jewish.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with a Chinese lady a couple months ago, and she was complaining about the lack of Chinese people. And she was talking about how when she goes down the street and she sees another Chinese person, that they often will share eye contact and a slight nod to try to, you know, as a way of commiseration with one another. And I said, gee, you know, that's touching. I said, you know, a couple like years ago, I was in Shanghai. There's tons of Chinese there.
Yes.
I mean, if you're really interested in like seeing lots of them, I can find you places where you can go, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to come here and try to like make me feel guilty over the fact that, well, there's too many of us and too few of you.
To be an immigrant, then complain that you're a minority
talk
about chutzpah.
Yeah. Well, it's chutzpah, and it's also you've been indoctrinated. You know, they just like these guys on the street. I mean, do you really think? I mean, just imagine the world that they're going to create. I mean, what they're creating is like South Central Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
that's what's going to Europe will become. There, I mean, there is no trajectory for this. This is the group that was in the street, the group that has this political power, the group that is in alignment.
Well, this is ethnic warfare, as we don't realize, and the Jews are particularly good at it, and they're particularly good at disarming the group that they're targeting, and at the main, at the same time, maintaining their their ethnic identity and their organizational capabilities through various narratives of victimology and these things. And of course, their domination of media and finance helps maintaining that narrative. But I was doing some reading about this affirmative action case that was recently issued by the court. And it's about Harvard and some of the Ivy League schools. And Harvard is a good example of this, how in the early 20th century, the WASPs was a WASP institution that controlled Harvard, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They noticed that there was a huge increase in Jewish students at Harvard. I think in the 1920s, it peaked at like 30%. This, bearing in mind that I think the Jews at the time were less than 1% of the US population. So they started putting in quotas to restrict how many Jews were at Harvard. And I think it dropped down like 15% still, thinking they're between 1% and 2% of the US population. And they're 15% of the people at Harvard, students at Harvard, they're still heavily overrepresented. Now, I don't know if that's, you know, their hard work and their higher intelligence, that may be that, or if they're at, you know, some sort of networking in these things at the time, it might have just been their effort. So that was maintained up until after the Second World War in the 50s and 60s, there was agitation to remove that. And their numbers started to increase at Harvard again, get up to like 30%. And it was that time that the Jews there and Jews across the country started agitating for affirmative action for racial minorities like Blacks and Hispanics. And what happened is the affirmative action, the lowering of standards to admit more Black and Hispanic students into Harvard, only impinged on white Christians. It did not impinge on the students at Harvard, Jewish students at Harvard. It continued to increase. In fact, Harvard increasingly became a Jewish-run institution. And the affirmative action case regarding the Asians, it didn't seem to be a problem because until Asians being so successful academically started to impinge upon the Jews at Harvard. And that's when they imposed this quota on Asians. So they were all for promoting minorities when it would limit the amount of white Christian students at Ivy League institutions, but they were against it when it started to impinge upon their representation and the student body at Harvard. And that's when, what I'm saying is these minorities, particularly Blacks and Hispanics, are used to nudge whites away from these, out of these institutions. Because if you go to schools outside the Ivy League, whites are dominate the other schools. It's the Ivy League institutions that become increasingly Jewish and also minority, and they've nudged the whites out. It factors greatly because this is the pathway for political power and also cultural and economic power in the United States is through these elite institutions, for better or for worse.
Exactly. So, that's the thing, is that these institutions are completely corrupt, but yes, they are the pathway to political power. I mean,
but it was interesting. They advocated for minority set-asides and promotion to the university until it started to impinge upon Jews at Harvard. That's when they cracked down on the Asians. But yeah, the thing is, they're using the Asians, they're using the Hispanics and the Blacks, first the Asians, and they stopped the Asians, using the Asians, to limit the whites at these schools, because whites represent an ethnic group, because their sheer numbers and also the high level agency and intelligence and ability, a competitive ethnic group to Jewish power. And what you're seeing is a raw ethnic interest being pursued under the guise of racial set-asides, diversity. It's what we're seeing in France too, where they're getting rid of the historic Gallic French culture to promote a Babel, a racial mix that will much more easily exploited and controlled under the guise of, again, diversity and human rights. So it's the same old trick.
Right. Exactly right. So, you know, this is repeated around the world. George Floyd comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, the transgender agenda comes mm-hmm. to mind. Now, you know, you have the French riots, all the same thing. Mm-hmm. 100%, just different manifestations of an attempt for control, power, and the people who are suffering are told, well, are not given any kind of clarity because they don't have a media that enables them to know who's attacking them.
And Jewish overrepresentation is never a reason for suspicion of nepotism or favoritism.
Of course not. Or racism.
Yes. Right?
It's never happened. So there it is, you know, it's just the Europeans are bamboozled, and of course, so are the North Africans.
Mm-hmm.
They're all just bamboozled for political and economic purpose, but it all ends up in one big clump of debased humanity that's going to be a slave state.
And there was one thing is that we can look back at some of the quotas against Jews at Harvard, and you can say, that's so racist, so cruel. And says, well, there was some wisdom to it, because there was some acknowledgement that if you do open it up to Jews without any restrictions, they will take over the institution and use it for their own ethnic interests. By the way, they have.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Well, maybe there should have been quotas.
So I'm saying what I'm suggesting here is the acknowledgement that ethnicity matters and ethnic interests matter. And to convince the yourself, only white ethnics can acknowledge this. Well, then What you're saying is that they can't act collectively, and they're just individuals that can be picked off one by one, you know?
Yeah, pretty true.
So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Well, thank you so much, and we'll get them next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.